Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, why are people into that, listeners? It's Tina here. I want to let you know real quick about an exciting update on my comic Safe Sex. Safe Sex, or SFSX for short, is a science fiction comic book series written and created by me, featuring a fucking amazing art team. It's about sex rebels in an American dystopia, and our heroes, of course, are a group of queer, kinky sex workers who call themselves the Dirty Mind. So, like, guests and listeners of this podcast, basically. The first book, Safe Sex Protection, is available now wherever books and comic books are sold. And the follow-up is coming later on this year. Safe Sex Terms of Service is a techno-thriller that asks the question, do you need an organic body in order to experience love and pleasure? Now, anybody who loves Why Are People Into That is sure to be a fan of this new book, which explores many of the same themes of this here show in the context of a darkly funny action-adventure for grown-ups. So my really big news is that we are launching a Kickstarter in order for people to pre-order the new book. The Kickstarter campaign is going to run from March 15th to April 15th, 2021. But if you're hearing this the week of March 15th, 2021, you only have a few days to get the early bird special deal and be the first to snag some of the tiers that have limited editions. There's pledge levels to get your hands on the out-of-print floppy issues signed by me, plus some brand new swag, including an enamel pin and posters and risographs, and even the chance to get yourself drawn into the new book. Despite being a punk DIY creator my entire life, this is my very first Kickstarter. So if you love Why Are People Into That and you've been looking for a way to support my work, this is an exceptionally meaningful way to do just that and get lots of great books and merch and experiences. And here's a few ways you can find out more. You can sign up for my mailing list, tinahorn.net/signup. I promise not to spam you. It's going to be updates on the Kickstarter and then periodic updates on new episodes of this podcast, book projects, classes I'm teaching, the kind of stuff you want to hear about. And of course, if you're not already, you should definitely follow me at tinahornsass on Twitter and Instagram. You can follow and support the project on Kickstarter itself by searching for Tina Horn, that's T-I-N-A-H-O-R-N, or SFSX Terms of Service, or this URL. Are you ready? I promise this is one of the only times I'm going to read this long of a URL on this show. kickstarter.com/projects/Tina Horn/SFSX-terms-of-service-graphic-novel. Okay, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for tuning into Why Are People Into That and reading my weird comics. And now, on with the show. Yin, my love, how are you?
Hi. Oh, Tina, I am doing very well right now. I have had a quiet day. which I don't usually get because I have little ones. And so I've had a quiet morning. It's snowing over here. I'm right now surrounded by trees. I'm out of the city at the moment. And yeah, I'm really grateful to be able to just have a you know, a serene morning, a serene day, and just enjoy the quietness. I also should mention that I have not gone on any links, and I have listened to no news this morning on purpose, so that I would not be filling my head with any of the outside jabber and just, you know, enjoy the quiet falling of the snow. So it's been good to unplug.
Yeah, that serenity is so healing and so vital in all times, but absolutely right now. So that's nice. That's like a nice, happy place that I am going to take myself to when I need to take a deep breath. I'm just going to imagine being with you, but quietly in the woods, watching little flurries of snow.
I do expect you to visit at some point. Oh, but yes. It's just so lovely to hear your voice. Like your voice is just a joyful one for me. It definitely brings up like all of the fantastic times together on stage and at PS1 and raising money for sex workers at, you know, Kink Out. So yeah, it's great to be here.
The last great party that I attended were thrown by you, and I feel like that is one of your great natural talents, is holding space for all levels of ritual, which is a part of your practice, but being able to hold space for celebratory rituals, also known as parties, which is a kind of energy that I am just like an absolute, speaking of natural talents, that I'm just an absolute succubus of. That is like where I draw, that is the fucking deep well where I draw so much of my energy, and I have been cut off from the source, from that natural resource in the past year. But so when I really try to tap into good memories of the perfect balance of well-curated company and well-curated food and music and intention and vibes and conversation and intense sexual energy, I think of you.
Oh, so, that's so great.
So thanks for those. For those memories. And I, and you know, thanks for also giving me hope for more parties in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I think that's been really hard, especially with the work that we do with, you know, sex worker rights activism. I feel like we are constantly doing this hard work, these hard conversations, even, you know, having this incredible, beautiful book of We Too by my bedside,
so
and like have
good.
And reading through it, like I have to give myself pause because it brings up so much of why we are fighting the resilient voices, but also and like the incredibly beautiful vulnerabilities. But then you have to take a deep breath because we used to be able to then go from having these kinds of conversations to the karaoke bar.
Yes.
Or to the disco night or to the gay club and like, you know, or to the stage where we could get paddled on stage in front of like, you know, hundreds of people or in our own dungeons.
To the bath, to the hot tub, to the mm-hmm. to the walk in the park, to the bike ride, to the beach.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of these places where we could fill our cups. Our succubus mm-hmm. cups. It's stark now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So how do we find those spaces of like celebration for ourselves and just like relaxing, of having that drink with each other, of toasting to the full moon? What is that ritual equivalent? And I think that your voice is my ritual equivalent of like being able to feel like, yes, this is where we have to gather and thrive and not just survive too. So yeah, thank you for continuing to do this podcast and
getting all
the equipment to together that you need to do this in virtual spaces.
Thank you, Yin. You're also so good at gratitude and at plumping me up, plumping everybody up. I feel. you're like the lip filler of the community.
I love it. I'm Botox.
it's also nice to hear that I'm not the only one who is in love with the sound of my voice. So let me introduce you. Ian has been on Why Are People Into That before, a couple of years ago, talking about Mercy Mistress. You should go back and check out that episode. And I'm so happy to have you here to talk about We Too, Essays on Sex Work and Survival, which comes out in a couple of days, February 9th, 2021. Let me read your updated bio for everyone. Yin Q is a mother, kink educator, writer, and activist based in New York City. Their media work includes Mercy Mistress, a web pilot, and Fly in Power, a short documentary. They founded a production team called Kink Out. Man, production team is like one way of putting it. Kink Out is so much. They founded a production team called Kink Out and organized with Red Canary Song, an APIA and Asian migrant sex and massage worker collective. Yin has been recognized by Spike Lee as an impact activist in his tribute to Jackie Robinson. Tell me about that. What's the connection between, what's the triangulation of Yin Q, Spike Lee, and Jackie Robinson?
Right, because I have to admit that I never watched baseball. Okay. But that said, of course, you know, this is kind of a story that I was a little bit embarrassed to tell for a little while. I was incredibly honored, of course, and flattered to have a call out, I think it was like a year and a half ago, asked, you know, by a producer to come onto set and to be filmed as part of a list of impact activists, people who are like doing moving and shaking in New York City for Spike Lee's tribute film for Jackie Robinson. And then once I got there, so excited, you know, I put on my leathers to rep my community and got there and met these really phenomenal activists who were just doing things from like, from, you know, urban farming to others, you know, helping girls survive depression, all different kinds of incredible work. I met the first female Asian firefighter of New York City, who was also, you know, became a captain. And as I was signing the waiver, I noticed that it was sponsored and I was being paid by Anheuser-Busch. So it is a beer commercial. So these are two things that like I have nothing really much to do with, both baseball and beer. I don't drink beer. I'm like, don't really watch baseball. But that said, I'm still so flattered. It was incredible to meet Spike Lee. And the fact that he's bringing a sex worker rights activist to stand along other activists was really important, I felt, to represent that.
That is fucking great. I feel like, in general, Spike Lee is somebody that you can trust to make good judgments about, like, we're going to get that corporate beer bag and we're going to use it strategically. You know,
yeah.
which is horror thinking, right?
Yeah. So. And I have to say, from like, you know, having read and also heard from other friends of how he works, but then also being on the set and meeting the producers behind the set and like the crew, it was really fantastic to see how many women, how many mothers were like black mothers were on set behind, you know, as crew.
And
so I was able to talk to them about, you know, oh, what are you doing for childcare? And they were like, oh, we'll make sure we get you money for childcare. You know, boom. I was like, oh my God, that rarely happens unless you're talking to another mother, you know? And yeah, so that was a fantastic experience for me for behind the set as well, I have to say.
Oh, that is so great. I am so happy to hear that. Before we get started talking about your essay, We All Deserve to Heal, from We Too, tell us a little bit about what is going on in 2021 with Kink Out.
Yes. So I know it seems like we've been a little quiet because we have, you know, not been able to gather.
Yeah.
However, definitely the work is being done behind the scenes. So at the present, we are in a residency with iBeam.
Love iBeam.
iBeam is an incredible organization. If you don't know it, look it up. It's iBeam.org. It's a tech organization that brings artists and tech people together to really create beyond the box, blowing up the box sort of, programs and technologies that challenge the way that, you know, systemic technologies have been created, as well as, especially with Sesta Fosta censoring our work online. So at this right now, we are in production of creating a private online art gallery for sex workers.
Fuck yeah.
And within this art gallery, it's this idea that all sex working artists and content makers and writers and people who just take a snapshot of themselves or just want to upload a video about like how their day is going, what does it look like, what's going on, what are their needs, what are their challenges, what are the dangers that they're facing at the time. If they just want to upload that, because those are the stories, those are these immediate stories that need to be archived, that they can do so for free by creating a profile and uploading their work, therefore creating an art space, an artist profile that is private, if they wish to keep it private. And they can then change the settings on each individual piece of artwork then to be shown to their either to their sex working comrades, so that it can be a space that is like sort of like that locker room, that safe locker room, where that's behind, you know, the strip stage or the den of the dungeon, or, you know, whatever space it is that, like, as we were speaking about before, where we go to do karaoke, where do we get together to, like, just, you know, talk and share what our experiences are. So that's sort of that is the private space. And then there's a veil over that you can lift if you so wish, to as a little peep show to the patron who can look in to see your work. So it's a way to also be able to flag to art patrons as well as curators who are looking for sex worker art to be able to find the art, find the artist, be able to contact the artists through email to say, like, you know, like, how much is your piece of work? You know, it's like so that these works of arts and these creations can be, you know, easily gotten into the hands of the people who want to buy them. And this is also thwarts not only Sesta Fosta, but it's also this idea of like who is getting paid for our narratives right now, right?
Oh yeah.
Who is getting paid for our narratives? Is it going to be a producer for Netflix that's going to get paid for our narratives, or are we going to be able to sell our own stories? And that's really important right now. And that's what we're trying to create. This private gallery first with iBeam, and this is sort of a seed project. Hopefully our intention is to then grow it to a space where then we can launch in the future and also collaborate with many people on an international and global scale, hopefully, so that we can actually launch a sex workers museum. So that, that intention is to be able to work with organizations and curators, sex worker curators all over the world in different locales, so that people can voice their, you know, and show their art, write about what's going on for them, so that we can build an alliance that is through the lens of artwork, archiving, and storytelling.
This idea is so fresh. It's like walking down the street and seeing a plant you've never seen before in somebody's yard, or like seeing a plant that you thought you knew doing something that you didn't know it could do. It's such a fucking great idea, and I think it has so much potential. And in listening to you talk about it, I'm just sort of thinking about how, like, so many of those ideas and ideals, I feel like we've been trying to do in other platforms that already exist. Like, we've been trying to bring our narratives to Netflix. We've been trying to bring our narratives to podcasts, to art galleries, to these, like, structures, which is worthwhile work. But like you said, being outside the box, or like exploding the box wide open, this is both like a new and like forward thinking, like futurist thinking kind of content, like futurist in the sense of completely reimagining the structure, and reimagining the structure changes the terms of engagement between worker community, workers and patrons, and then also sex work community, the world of patrons and clients, with sort of the like voyeuristic outside world that is sort of observing what we're doing and putting it in political context, putting it in economic context, putting it in sociocultural context. Like, it's totally exploding, all of that. I'm so excited.
Thank you. Yeah, we are really excited. I am incredibly excited. I'm also, and when you talk about sociopolitical and, you know, and we have to say capitalist ideas of what's, how sex work has run and been, you know, fed other industries. And I wouldn't say feed, even, it's been poached upon, right? It's been poached upon by other industries.
Absolutely. Like, poached is totally the word. And everything that entails, from white supremacy to heteronormativity and so on.
Right. And I think that, like, one of the things we were thinking of, like, also is, like, how is even the structure, you know, we want to be really intentional, like, how is this even going to run on the internal side? Mm-hmm. So this may be, you know, something, a virtual space, but it's made of human bodies. And, like, how do we then organize on the other side of it, of the creation side? How do we make this a lateral movement? How do we make sure that that we can reach sex workers who want to be involved, you know? And we were talking about co-op methods and like co-op structures and like, you know, just like, so we're having like so many different conversations, not only from like, okay, how to create a museum, but we don't want to create a museum the way the museums have been created, right? Like, I don't want to go into the Met of sex workers museums, you know, like it, I don't want to go into the sterile environment where, you know, you walk into the Met and there's like all these, you know, there's over 100 depictions of rape in the Metropolitan Museum. And yet, like here, when we're creating an erotic, you know, when we try to create something beautiful and erotic online, it gets shadow banned. Obviously, so much of the work from other spaces have been stolen, right? So how do we create something intentionally in a way that can then also really reflect who we want to be as you know, as sex workers who are thinking about all of these pitfalls, I guess, that happens when you start to expand and try to grow ideas in this world that again and again has like tried to enforce a system of oppression on us.
Speaking of trying to bring sex work sense and sensibility into museum spaces, can we talk about spaces? Which was almost exactly a year ago at MoMA PS1 in New York City. There's like a lot of people listening to this who were there and involved in producing it and performing at it and designing it, who upon hearing that are just probably taking like a huge sigh, you know, of happiness, of remembering it, and also just like the weight of everything that we didn't know was on the horizon. But for the people who were not at Kink Out Spaces at MoMA PS1 in New York City in February of 2020, can you talk a little bit about what it, about the concept behind it, and then like, how did it go? How did it go? How did you feel about how it went?
So Spaces was incredible endeavor of Kink Out crew and volunteers and people and artists and you yourself getting up on stage and offering yourself to the lovely Mistress Ashley Page. And it was this idea of creating spaces for people who are underrepresented within the kink community, but also just a welcoming of leather, kink, queer, sex working cultures to be celebrated, but also a way for us to educate right? The newcomers into our lifestyles, to be able to educate them in a way that really provides that foundation of what is consent, right? So there was even like, there were even like pamphlets of what is consent? What does that even look like being handed out? There were, discussions. There were like for every station that you went to, whether it was a pet play station or whether it was Tamara Santibanez's incredible like foot station of printing, the ink printing of the soles of the feet. There was this idea of consent and negotiation and constant communication.
And it was also a leading by example in the sense that these two things that you're talking about were fully integrated in a way that is very, very difficult to do, where you could simultaneously be there as a queer person, as a sex worker, as a kinky person, be yourself and be with your community and have fun. And, you know, some people had roles, some people had jobs to do, and some people were there as attendees, as participants, as audience members, as voyeurs. There was very little asking people to step outside of their sense of presence and enjoying themselves in order to do that education component that you're talking about, right? Because, like, I'll speak for myself and say that I'm part of the work that I do is facilitating spaces for people who are new to, say, public play, like what was going on at the Dome at PS1, right? Puppy play, boot blacking, impact play, all kinds of things, not to mention fetish outfits and fashion of all kinds. There's like the time that I'm teaching a workshop, and then there's the time that I want to be at the fucking party, right? Mm-hmm. And if I'm being expected to switch back and forth, phase in and out of those two spaces, that can be quite exhausting, and it can compromise my ability to hold that space as a teacher and to be able to be present in that space as a participant, right? So you did something so special in integrating those, where there was very little to no time that day that I felt like I had to switch out of my mode of being myself to like be Tina Horn for like someone else's benefit, whether they're like paying for the privilege or not. And that's rare and hard to do. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. But also I have to say that I think that, I have to thank all of the incredible, like your, you know, community leaders and educators who were there. And I think that was on purpose too. So what you're speaking of is, I think, makes a difference that we had so many educators there, so that once, you know, at one time somebody would get up and educate the crowd, for example, the phenomenal artist Tiana McLeodin, speaking on, you know, Black history within leather communities, and then stepping down and like mingling or whatnot. And I feel like there was always there were so many people around to be able to step into those roles of like holding educational space, that then it was like, okay, my bit is over here. Now I can go into party mode, you know, or I can be both, right? Or I can do both. And at all times in the outside of the VW Dome in the art book, which is the store at PS1, they opened the space then for different panels to go on. So that Manhattan Alternatives was there, with kink therapists. There was Hacking Hustling speaking about, you know, what's going on with gentrification of the internet. And so like to have all of these other things going on where there's educationals or there's more arts or there's more artsy work, or you can just be flirting, you know?
Yeah.
It was fantastic. Like I was just overjoyed. So like when you asked me like, how do I think it went? I want to be like a little bit modest, but actually I think it was the fucking most amazing thing I've ever attended. I remember at one point I was sat down next to Troy Orleans, she's a Black dominatrix whom I've known for so long. And we've kind of seen the scene grow through like probably the past 15, 20 years, you know?
Yeah.
And I just remember her just saying, like, this is incredible how many, you know, BIPOC people are here. And I was like, isn't this, I just turned to her and just like, doesn't it feel like such an incredible relief? Like, you're just soaking it in. Like, you just need to, like, fill, it's just filling me, like, to the fingertips with joy. And I also just said, like, this is how it should be.
Both, like, looking around and being like, I did this, we did this, and also, this is the way that it always should be. And I guess in a way also, like, this is the way it always has been, but we haven't always been able to enjoy it in this way or on this scale. And yeah, I mean, friend of the pod, Troy Orleans, listen to her episodes on bondage from a few years ago. Like, if you're impressing Troy, then that's, you know.
Yeah,
she's not, absolutely. She's not easily impressed, I think.
For good reason.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, it felt really good. I mean, I also want to say that my time going into fetish clubs has always been okay. If I'm going in, there, you know, there's usually a smattering of Asian doms, but we are definitely the Asian doms, you know, like, right. And amongst the mostly white crowd, of you know, fetish kink crowd. And yeah. So to be able to go into that space, to create that space, but then, and have a beautiful array of skin tones and culture and ethnicities be clad in like leather and latex and all different kinds of fetish wear, and people just, you know, of all different backgrounds.
And body types too, and right. Ages.
But then also, I will have to say too that there was a white guy, a white cis man, who came to me and said, you know, I just want to let you know your kink out events are like the most friendly, warmest, most welcoming spaces I've ever been in, like in any of the like the kink spaces. And I feel like this proves like how once we when we raise our ideas of like we are raising and celebrating all identities, it doesn't exclude the other, you know? So
right, I think that's a zero sum game.
Right, exactly. And like, so we're not infringing on somebody else's like enjoyment of themselves, you know?
Oh my God, yeah,
we're actually just ensuring nonsense. That we're everybody's enjoying themselves. And
doing it in a way also where we're even what you were alluding to before, where like the presence of someone who is like deviating from that norm, I don't have to like list all the identity demarcations that like represent that norm, quote unquote norm, whatever the fuck that means.
Right.
The deviating from that norm either naturally or by choice is not presented as an object of fetish for the view of that norm. Right. Mm-hmm. Or for the entertainment or pleasure sense of edginess of that norm, right? The idea of like somebody not like going into a straight person going into a queer space and being like, wow, like I'm so cool and dangerous because I'm like in this queer space, taking the cues from the people in that space about how to engage and realizing that you can enjoy it without colonizing it.
Right. Right, because queer, like a queer space can be is welcoming.
I mean, it reminds me of this like Richard Hell quote about how like if your band is not your favorite band, then like what the fuck are you doing with your time? And so like what was it that made it the best party?
Yeah. And I think that the recipe is really too with like the people I was working with the people, the other producers on the team, right, all of the performers and all of the crew. I think that was the ingredients of just bringing together and then drawing in the people to come to the party, to come to the learning, to come to this like really incredibly sacred space. And so when I looked around, I was just constantly, like things were just constantly blowing my mind, you know, of seeing, as I said before, just like the spectacular amount of people who are enjoying themselves, being happy and like exploring leather or teaching leather, giving themselves the opportunity to just celebrate themselves.
I love to plan. Mm-hmm. But I also love spontaneity, and I love like just throwing myself into my ability to use my intuition to create something in the moment. Like, I'm definitely both like a Virgo, but also an agent of chaos. Like, that's just the paradox of being Tina Horn. But the way that I was able to engage in kink out spaces, I think will, speaking of like all-time greats, like I think it will carry with me my whole life as an example of something where we just sort of had a general idea of myself and Gia and Phoenix and Ashley. We're going to do some sort of impact play performance. And there wasn't a ton of pressure on like, what composition will you be performing for your recital and what key will it be in, right? It was like, we trust you. And Ashley and I had gotten together earlier that week and done a little bit of practicing, but also a really big part of the practicing was talking about the importance of music in that scene, the importance of music to impact play for us and the importance of music to performance for us, and like making a little playlist and then to that day be able to walk up to the DJ with like half a dozen songs and say, I trust you as a DJ. Here are some songs that we would love to play. And also like, feel free to riff on the vibe of these songs. Like, I think if you look at these six songs, you will like get what we're going for. And then to like be in this moment with this like really expensive state of the art sound system, like a nicer sound system than I have been able to perform to in many years. Again, just thinking about like how bereft I have been and we all have been in the past year of things like experiencing music through a high quality sound system in a big room designed for sound, also filled with bodies. Fuck, man. Like, so again, like going back to this moment of being filled up by like being able to be in a room and just like wearing boots and wearing leather and wearing a thong and feeling glamorous in the way that I wanted to and comfortable in the ways that I wanted to. And just being able to listen to Cardi B and play with my friends on stage and to just feel everyone in the room sharing that joy through the music, through the sadomasochism, through the glamour, through the performance, and also through that spontaneity. And spontaneity is another thing that is like in such short supply.
I remember you got like a round of applause for adjusting yourself as you sat down, adjusting like the under buttock, the little flat. Listen,
that's just yoga. That's just a yoga move, right?
But
there.
But do you remember that you got you got a room of applause? Like, I don't know.
You know, yeah. I'm just trying to, I know what I have to move out of the way in order to get my sits bones on the chair where they need to be in order for my center of gravity.
Oh, we were all so appreciative for your yoga move.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I guess part of what I'm saying is that it was a beautiful moment for like me. Of course, there's like vanity involved in that for me, being a theater kid and living for applause. But it really also exemplified something that is really true about me being a diva that like lives for applause so much, which is that ultimately what it's about is making other people happy by entertaining them. It's in service to the audience. Like, that's what I'm there to serve them with my ass or, whatever.
Yeah.
Ooh, it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah. No, I see that in you. We recognize that, darling.
Good.
That's good. That's one of the aspects we love about you.
After all, thank you.
I believe like one of you've got showbiz attached to your email, right?
That's true. A tattoo by Tamara Santibanez. Right. Yeah, it's all community is all interconnected. Yeah, and also everybody listening to this podcast is like, duh. we also know this, Tina.
I have to say too, I am not so much a performer anymore. But as a producer of these events, I do love people having fun. I love people coming in and like that they are the audience of the show that I have helped create, of the space that I have helped create. They are also, you know, creating that space as well. And so I really love seeing how and bringing people like you who are so good at and thrive on that audience vibe and feeding back and forth, where it's just like a really lovely flow that happens. And I was thinking about writing as well, because we're going to talk about writing a little bit.
Yes,
I am not a writer who just writes into the oblivion. Like, there's definitely people who have talked about like that they don't necessarily write for an audience; they just write because they have to write, they have to get it out of them. And I used to think that that was me as well. I thought, you know, as a younger, like, teenage, angsty person who really just needed to write, I believed myself to be that kind of writer who was just going to write till my bones were bare and, you know, with the nubs and, like, write with my own blood and ink. But but I've gotten to, it's hard to find the time to do writing, you know?
Yeah.
And I've really thought about, like, well, I've been sitting on this memoir for so long that, like, and one of the reasons I haven't kept going back to it to write is because I write for an audience. Like, I need that audience. So when you actually invited me to write for We Too, that's when I could go actually had the interest again to be like, oh, let me take a look at my memoir. I have so much to write about. I have so much that I've already written about, you know, these moments.
Well, what incredible topping from the bottom segueing you're doing for me right now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Essie Fleenor.
And I'm Sarah Sentry. We are the host of Bitches on Comics, a comic book podcast that is about comics and bitches.
That's it. That's the show. We're dedicated to exploring comics and pop culture through the lens of gender and sexuality. You can find us on bitchesoncomics.com or on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's talk about We Too. Thank you for talking about Kink Out. It really is making me happy. And
I'm happy too. I definitely feel like we're in a bar with each other and just just having a good celebratory time right now together.
Yeah, we should fucking pat ourselves on the back. shit's rough. I distinctly remember when Natalie West, who is the editor and creator of We Too, Essays on Sex Work and Survival, asked me if I would come on as and we settled on the title of associate editor for me. And I knew that part of what I wanted to do was to reach out to people in my community who might have a story that they wanted to contribute to the general prompt of this book, which is, you know, sex workers responding to Me Too, sex workers talking about consent culture, really anything related to the topic of consent and how it has affected your life as a sex worker, which, as evidenced by the book, can go in so many different directions. And I'm so glad that we have so many different directions represented in this book. And I very much remember asking you if you wanted to contribute, and then I got you on the phone, and I had just gotten off the bus, and I was outside my apartment in Brooklyn, and you were able to talk right then, and I just walked around my block like 20 times talking to you and talking it out, because as I remember, you were a little bit like, I think I want to write about this, but I don't know if that is appropriate for this prompt. And I was like, are you kidding? It's perfect. So do you want to talk to me about what you remember about that moment and what made you choose this particular story to write about, and then we can talk a little bit about what the story is.
So I want to say that there are definitely parts of this essay that I had written already, especially parts about my father, as well as the piece about me at the burlesque strip club and the rape to me. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you had asked me, though, at that moment of what, you know, what would you like to hone in on, writing about a client who hadn't raped me, but who had come to me as, you know, somebody who wanted me to work with them as somebody who has been the rapist. I think it was in my mind, first of all, because it's been in my mind for a very long time, you know, his story in those moments and kind of my silence, my complicity into those moments of his confessions. But then also coming out of a time when, you know, people were being called out, and there was somebody else also in our community who is very well known, who's a writer, who was being called out too heavily. And it made me actually think about, and I wasn't going to write about that story, because it was just too complicated at the time. And but I was thinking about how many people are in our midst, even if I've gotten like an ick vibe from, or somebody who I'm like friendly, but like at arm's length friendly, whom I've had in my home or have had in my events or have had, you know, who are these people who still need community, because then like once they're called out, they were then completely shut out of their communities. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. You know, I don't believe that victims or people around them need to necessarily stay within contact. You know, I think that everybody has their own decisions. It's that really difficult conversation of like, how do these people then heal? How do they learn? And do they learn? And do they, or are they just apologizing? Do they ever apologize just to save face? Do they ever apologize just to hear themselves say it, or have other people hear them say it? But how do they truly heal, and how do we truly heal as community? You know, as somebody who has also been an event organizer, being somebody who has been friendly or friends with people who have been accused of abuse, as well as the other side or the people who are calling them out, the victims, I'm constantly also just like trying to have these hard conversations, not only in my head, but like to my community, you know, how do we heal? So when a friend had told me, you know, everyone deserves to heal, even rapists, I was like, done. Let me go into this and see, what does it mean to me? I think that there's definitely things of, you know, parts of this book that I, or sorry, parts of this essay that I was worried about writing because I didn't do anything. I was part of the culture of being quiet.
Yeah.
I didn't like stand there and like start to berate him or shut him out or tell him, you know, how fucked up he is and like never to, you know, or to try to educate. I don't know. I just didn't do that. I will be honest. Like as I said, you know, I dissociated and really felt like at that time I felt powerless.
It is such a magical thing to read something that you've read a million times on a screen in a book, both because of the finality of like, I don't know, it's a release of control, and you talk about control a lot in your piece in a beautiful way, a way that's very meaningful to me. But it releases a little bit of control to read either something that I've written or that I have edited or you know, helped somebody to write, to read it in the book and be like, okay, well, there's no changing that word choice. There's no changing that punctuation. There's no changing this syntax. Like, this is the way it is in this book. And then also having the tactile experience of reading it. But I was rereading it, and there are two moments that you talk so lyrically and beautifully about disassociation. And one is, I pulled on my clothes as though I were dressing a mannequin. And the other is, A tendril of smoke floated upward, and along with it, I felt myself unhinged from my body and hover above, watching my hands that had just been holding this man's body so close to my own.
Yeah.
There are themes of control. There are themes of disassociation. There are themes of forgiveness that you use as like recurring motifs in this story that are so beautiful and emotional and had such an impact on me both the first time I read it and as we worked on it together and now in this final form. I can't wait for people to read it.
Thank you. As you said that, you know, once people start to read it, then it's their own and it's outside of me then. And these things are definitely scary. So yeah. I'm definitely handing people over this vulnerability of being judged, you know, and I think that was so scary for me because, and I'm going to just go back, you know, reiterate something that's really out there within our sex worker rights narrations now of like, you know, we ourselves sometimes feel like we have to be the sex worker heroes, you know, the happy hooker. Otherwise we're the victim. And if we're the victim, then obviously sex worker rights doesn't work. Right. Somehow it doesn't make sense. And like to have these ideas that there's these binaries and not all these gray areas is really scary. It's really, really scary.
Well, it's almost like that fear is strategic to keep us discombobulated and to keep us from actually testifying to the world about our experience of what has really happened to us.
And I think that even just that idea of like dissociation, that's not the only time it happened, you know, with that one person.
Yeah.
You know, there was many times of dissociation that happened throughout sex work. And it's not that I can't say, you know, it's not that I'm going to say now that I didn't have a great career. I loved being a sex, you know, doing the work that I was doing.
Yeah, of course,
it's work.
Too.
It's work, though, and it comes with its problems, and it's really intimate, vulnerable work that we don't have, or we didn't have as many. I mean, probably still don't. We don't have just as many, you know, safety features or like trainings or understandings of like what are we doing and how are we getting into these spaces and how are we going to safely keep ourselves emotionally safe from the work that we're actually doing.
What is that even? Look like being emotionally safe? Like, is that possible? Right. Is that a goal? Like, do we want, I don't know, this is something I'm thinking about a lot with Safe Sex, my comic, like, what does a world look like where we are emotionally safe? And is that actually our goal? And is that even possible? Is it possible to feel good without the risk of feeling bad? I'm not sure.
That's true. And that's a very, and especially within work that, intimate work that we do. I mean, I'll refer to your story as well, your essay within We Too as well, of like just this idea that like we're going into these spaces where we're trying to be brave or trying to create this consent around us. Mm. And I'm going to be honest, like, you know, we're trying to be that tough person, you know, especially since it comes with the kink, it comes with our punk persona, comes with, you know, for me, the goth persona.
Yeah.
And like, so to be tough and then also to be able to handle everything that comes to us, right, is also just like an incredibly scary position to be in when you're then being faced by a client who has.
Yeah. Or managers. Yeah.
Who have no regard for that, you know, and have brings so much ignorance and disregard for what we're trying to create for those spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it is ignorance, and I think sometimes it's actually like a knowledge of what we want that becomes so warped. The knowledge becomes warped, but also the like motivation that person has of like how they think that they are going to get their needs to feel powerful and in control satisfied. Like, I think that sometimes people get into this mode where they gain the powers of discerning, like you were talking about my piece, like if somebody with a lot of experience in BDSM meets me and maybe has a skill, I'll say generously, for sizing me up, appraising me is a word that I use in my essay, and figuring out what this really means to me, where my pride is, and then going about trying to undermine it. And like, I think that the sort of the thesis of my piece is that that is like the antithesis of like what BDSM has meant to me. And by the way, to sort of, again, integrate both our conversation about Kink Out and our conversation about We Too, the reason that I am able to tell the difference, and I'm not saying that I have 100% success rate, but like my skills of discernment between an abusive scam and the kind of BDSM that I want to be involved in personally and professionally, that discernment comes from two main places. One is books, and being somebody who reads a lot about anything that I'm interested in, and sex is, you know, easily conversation for top three things that I've been interested in my life and therefore want to read about in my life. And that's fiction and nonfiction have both helped me in that way, which is part of the reason I want to make books to be, you know, pushes glasses up on nose. But then community, and I use that term more just broadly to say like the, you know, my fellow sex workers that I worked with in the dungeon, the other sex workers that I've made pornography with, and these are the people who have taught me how to tell the difference. These are the people who have stood by me while I've had the experiences that have honed my instincts for telling the difference. And these are also the people that I can come to and say, I had this experience. Can we break this down? Like, can we talk about it? Like, here's how I'm feeling. Can we put it in context? And like being that for other people. And like, that is something that comes up in so many different people's stories in this book as well. Like the kind of community that you have attracted with the beacon of Kink Out. And in many cases, those are communities that have been thriving for decades, and a lot of different communities coming together and finding commonality.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe the idea is not like keeping each other safe, like completely protected, like swaddled and, you know, helicopter, like parented, like from the world, or giving each other like Munchausen by proxy. I guess maybe like a better word in my mind is support, like like people who are there for you so that you can take risks, so you can scrape your knees, so that you can have bad experiences. And then as you frame in your story the most important overarching theme of your story, and the title of the story is that we all deserve to heal, and like in life we're going to have bad experiences, and so then like how do we support each other in our healing, and how do we support each other so that we are resilient for the moments that bad or scary things are happening, so we can either take ourselves out of harm's way or not feel like as destroyed by those experiences.
I agree with you. I think that community is huge. It's also finding those, you know, those people, certain people in community where you find that they're the ones who accept everything that comes out of your mouth and like and holds it and may listen to you, help you come to better understandings when needed, right? Definitely supportive community rather than safe space. It's a brave space that we're going into, right? It's not always going to be safe. It, as you said before, like these are not going to be emotionally safe spaces all the time. There's just, you know, too much intimacy. There's so much power loaded into so many different aspects of what we do and how we enjoy playing and with the power. I mean, one of the lines that I loved in your piece was power was to be played with, to be understood. You know, it's not that we're taking away power from any of these and that possibility of hurt from any of these things, but we're playing with it. I want to say to, and I think this is part of my confessions to the book as well, that, you know, during my time as a dom, being in house with doms was such an incredible experience for me. And then, honestly, like once I went independent, and then, you know, I would host you know, educational classes and whatnot. But at the same time, there was still that element that was very hard to break down within DOMS, within New York City at that time, the generation that I was in, at least. Mm. And that was one of competition.
Ah.
You know, and I feel like, especially if you're kind of like one of the, you know, DOMS that showed up at the top of Arrow's Guide or whatever, you know, like there was like this slight, there was always this taste of competition with the friendships that I had with a lot of other pro DOMS. And then it was the queer spaces and the, you know, my queer community where I felt most like, this is where I come to talk, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't always having the same experiences then with necessarily, sometimes I'd be really ashamed to speak about experiences that I had with clients, to speak about it to like my friends in the leather community,
yeah.
You know, because there was also still that stigma against sex work, even within leather cultures, certain parts of leather cultures. So I feel leather queer cultures, and that still goes on too. I still get a sniff of it once in a while, but it's less.
Same, but I think that is one of the things that is so powerful about Kink Out. I'm biased because Kink Out represents the overlapping of the Venn diagram where I feel the most fucking comfy. It's like the place where I have like a hammock set up between my two favorite trees.
Yes.
And so many other people have done really powerful work to make it so that, you know, a like sex work exclusionary queer space is like, who wants to go to that party?
Right. And so that's, yeah, exactly. That's why I feel like that's what motivated me to create Kink Out. That's what I get so much pleasure in seeing of creating these spaces. And that's also actually, I will say, like, as somebody who is considered an elder in like the leather and sex work communities, that I feel like I'm also so incredibly happy to see a younger generation of DOMs of sex workers and of, you know, queers who are embracing each other and creating alliances, and that there's, I don't know, I'm not operating within somebody who's putting up ads and trying to get clients at this time, but I'm hoping, and I feel like there's just a warmer camaraderie.
Yeah.
You know, and there were definitely pockets, you know, of people who would get together and like sex workers, but they're like, I remember once I arrived to New York City and I was trying to get a bunch of DOMs together for a tea, or, you know, like actually just some kind of like, you know, gathering to be able to talk. I remember one of the DOMs just telling me like, you're never going to get this many cats in a room. You know, we've all got our wits out and ready for each other. And I was just like, really, I was really dissuaded by that. And even when I went to, LA, this, you know, for the Mercy Mistress screening, one of the DOMs said to me, like, they were just amazed that I had gotten so many of the DOMs, pro DOMs, into the same room. And like, there were people in that room who, you know, had beef with each other for like generations or something. Oh, I don't know. It was like, you know, one of those reigns of legacies or something. I hope to see that is a, you know, that is dissolving within this unifying idea of like, well, you know, we are stronger together. Mm. We are safer together if we can build these alliances and keep going. And so I think that that's part of like this idea of also offering my really vulnerable spaces of self-doubt and I don't want to say weakness, but like of like real trauma, this, the trauma of dissociation, the trauma of like these spaces of silences, to this essay, because that's so real, right? We're not just armored DOMs. We're not just armored, you know, like we're not just feminists who can take to the streets and they're so tough and like can, you know, bring everybody together in Times Square. And like, thank God we are that too.
Yeah. But being expected to be that 24/7 or not having our vulnerabilities recognized is a denial of our personhood.
Exactly.
We might have personas and we might be available to play characters, but, you know, I think because of criminalization and because of stigma, we are expected to be those personas all the time in a way that other kinds of performance artists, I think that people have a sense of when they're on and when they're off. And It's just not fair.
Mm-hmm.
I would love it if you would talk about your decision to read your essay in its entirety at MoMA PS1 at a different day that was a part of the same residency that we called Leather Lit Day, which was both a zine making and a letter writing to incarcerated sex workers, just a general sort of more low-key daytime event that then involved some readings and an open mic and was just, you know, also a wonderful different kind of party, a more of a literary event. And you hadn't planned on reading your piece, had you?
No.
What inspired you to read it that day?
Well, honestly, it's because we had more time in that beautiful art book space. And you had read in the beginning, along with other phenomenal writers. And your Leather Lit Day, the bookstore was packed. But it was packed with you, with Ashley Page as our hostess, KD, Bridget.
Woo, and Nico, and
Aza,
Eve, and...
Right, and it was our family. Mm-hmm. Right? If I was going to do a reading for anyone first for this piece, it had to be family.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can't have anybody else pick up this piece. And since then I have, like, who are not within the queer leather sex work culture. Working with this piece with you, where you really dual-ed this piece for me, was really an interesting process of writing, first of all, because I've reached backwards into writing that I had already written and then also wrote about the client in, mm-hmm. and that was a completely new writing for me. And mm-hmm. I will say I had to actually dissect myself from my family to write mm-hmm. this piece. I knew that I'd have to. I had to make sure that I wasn't going to have to go downstairs and make dinner for my kids that, mm-hmm. you know, that same day of writing this work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was during a time when I was able to, or when I was doing workshop at a college, and I was able to then take a few days to stay where I was in the hotel and write this piece.
Mm.
Then to be able to speak it out loud, read it out loud to the familiars of our extended leather family, just seemed right.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I was also still feeling very vulnerable. I was like right after I had to go sit down next to one of my partners and just like kind of gather strength. But I knew I was with family, you know, ripping your heart out and putting it in front of strangers is so hard. I was just ripping my heart out and putting it in front of you all, whom I knew you were all just going to swaddle that heart, that bleeding heart, you know, like you were going to swaddle it. You were going to help take care of it. And you all did, you know, you all just like just by your faces, your touches, your hugs, your love afterwards. It was so necessary. You know, I want to say in contrast to, I've actually given the piece to a friend to read who is actually outside of all of these spheres, who is actually a parent friend. Who knows me, but and who I'm good friends with, but they are a cis white male and don't really understand all the nuances of like our culture and like who we are, how we expect each other to be, you know, to behave, and it was jarring to speak to him about it afterwards.
Yeah.
It was really jarring. The questions that came out of his mouth or the comments that came out of his mouth was odd, even the timing of like when he chose to speak to me about it, which was actually while I was cooking for the family.
I mean, even, like, even that.
And I'm not speaking about my partner here because like my partner's definitely on the inside of our leather family, but totally. I'm speaking about somebody else who's a parent of, you know, and I actually had to turn to him, spatula in hand, and say, this is not the time for me to talk about that piece of writing. This is not, and like I was going to say this, but the kids were there. Like, this is not a time for me to talk about rape. And like, you would have known that, you know, like, and then we get back to again, like, who is outside of this idea of consent, right? Who is not being taught consent culture?
Even the consent of talking about your piece about consent and knowing when is the time and place, or even to before launching into it, you know, checking in with you about how you might feel about talking about it, giving you the opportunity to say not now.
Right. You know, in this time and age, we're not at a point where we can rely on the empathy of others to understand when is it time? Like, when are these things right and not? It constantly has to be worked. It constantly our boundaries constantly have to be up and talked about and you know, just
yeah,
scaffolded and mortared and bricked.
And with a moat, maybe.
Exactly.
A drawbridge.
So this book in itself, I mean, beyond my own, you know, my own essay of how I feel about my essay being in print and out there, this book of all of these voices, by the way, this phenomenal amount of stories, narrations, essays, and research. Oh my God, it is incredible, Tina, what you and Ms. Natalie West have done and that Feminist Press has supported. I just feel like this has got like the blood, the guts, and the brains of just so many people.
Definitely tears and sweat and
yes.
Spunk and piss probably.
You know, it definitely feels like this anthology just pulses.
Mm.
And I'm just blown away. Like I've read only, I will say I've only read one third. I'm like kind of like creeping through it of like trying to read one essay every 2 to 3 days, you know, because you have to give yourself time.
It needs
time
some digesting.
Between. Yeah. Yeah.
I appreciate you saying that so much.
It's incredible. And I'm so proud to be part of this.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, and I'm so proud that you're involved, and I'm so proud of you for creating this piece. And I just really do remember being so proud of you that day at Leather Lit Day when you chose to read it, because I knew how hard that would be. And in order to testify about something that happened to you, whether verbally to a small group or on stage to a huge crowd or in print online or in print in a book or a magazine or a zine or in one-on-one conversation or anything else, like, a story does not have to be well articulated or crafted in order to be worth telling,
mm-hmm.
right? In order to be mm-hmm. worth saying. At the same time, for me, speaking as a creative person and as an artist, I feel like taking an experience, you know, as somebody who, you know, works a lot in nonfiction and is very interested in reading and writing and listening to nonfiction and creating spaces like this podcast for nonfiction conversations, I feel that taking an experience that has happened to you and turning it and crafting it into a story, making it into a piece, meticulously crafting every word, creating sentences, and creating those kind of motifs that I was talking about and returning to themes the way that you know, I'm not going to talk too much about the details of your piece because I want people to read it, but, you know, they're in right in the center of the piece, there's an image of two different figures in the story, and your story jumps around throughout many different points in your lifetime. There's two figures in the story who are on their knees asking for forgiveness, and you're witnessing it in both cases, but in both cases, you're not the person to give this person forgiveness, this person who's on their knees asking for forgiveness. To me, all of the violence and pain and sorrow and trauma that you talk about in this piece between your family, with your friends, in your work, with your community, so many different relationships in this small story, especially hearing you then read it out loud in your voice in a space that you created for such stories to be shared. There is something magical about that. You're like transubstantiating your pain into art. I know that sounds pretty corny, but I felt that so intensely with your piece, more than maybe even I've experienced in my life as a creator. And I am just, this is part of the reason that I wanted to really have this conversation with you on this podcast and break down the process and talk more about the story in the context of the book as it is released into the world, and more people are gonna get to experience it in the context of all the other stories of this book. And I'm just I'm so grateful to you, and I feel so proud of us for making it happen. Everyone that contributed to making it happen, and I'm so glad that it's preserved in this book for people to read for hundreds and thousands of years, for the aliens to read. Oh God!
Yes,
aliens get a hold of this book. They're gonna be like, damn.
Yeah, we'll be on the next golden record that, you know, NASA sends off into the
totally into Chuck the Berry world. And we too.
Yeah. No, I'm. Thank you. I'm proud of this too. I want to thank you as an editor too for really working with me in the structure, because I'm a terrible editor of my own work. And I think, you know, most writers are.
It's hard.
Taking old writing and then fusing it into the new is, you know, is also usually not recommended. But this time it just felt like the right thing to do, especially since there were mirrors of, as you said before, of like two people who were the offenders.
You always know that it is that you're on the right track when, whether it's concrete detail or a theme or something where you start to see parallels. Like if you're trying to weave together two stories, you know that it's going to be seamless when you're starting to see how things can play off one another, and there's so much power in that.
Yeah, I do love writing when it feels this bloody.
It's bloody.
I do love, you know,
and sweaty and you know, tear soaked. Like, there's like earwax. I'm just trying like the dirt that gets under your fingernails. I'm just like every kind of gunk.
Yeah, absolutely. Digging in and tapping the vein is really important to me in my writing, in this kind of writing for me. And I do love it, but it is like that thing where it is a sadomasochistic feeling of like, you need to tap that vein. You need to dig in deep. You can't really have people around you making small talk. You can't, you know, so like it is painful. And yet then it's so, you know, I'll use the word cathartic for lack of another word, but like it is that beating that, you know, resonates and feels so good afterwards and releases you of the pain as well. So
yeah, you have a beautiful moment too in your piece of articulating how BDSM can be healing. And it reminds me of a sequence in Lorelei Lee's piece too, where she talks about both BDSM and porn making. You both talk about it in a deeply felt and deeply thoughtful, lyrical way. And, you know, my piece touches on those themes, and I could go on and on with the pieces in here that list. I think that something that I really love about this book is that the moments, you know, in large part the themes are about pain and suffering, frankly, and violence. And when people talk about the positive aspects of sex work, sex, BDSM, non-monogamy, you know, all of the different things that are explored in this book, it doesn't feel like an aside. It feels like a yes and, you know, it feels like all of these things can and should and do exist side by side. And like, that's not hard for us to wrap our minds around. It definitely seems to be hard for people who are anti-sex work or anti-porn or anti-kink or homophobic or transphobic, racist. It's hard for them to wrap their minds around for whatever fucking reason of being bigots.
Right.
But for us, it's like, yeah, dude, again, it's like, you can't deny us personhood by like expecting it to be all good or all bad. Who thinks that is the way that the world works?
Right. And it makes me question too, then how do they look at their own living experience?
Oh yeah.
You know, can any human on this earth look at their own experience and say that it's a perfectly consensual and happy time, or that they're full on victims and everything has been completely out of their control and terribly, you know, that said, like, yes, you know, I'm not going to include in that children. But the idea that, like, any busing coming to sex workers and saying that, like, well, these are the reasons why sex work shouldn't exist, because, you know, you've obviously been hurt, you've obviously experienced trauma within it, is to say, like, have you never experienced trauma, not only within your workspace, but in your day-to-day living? And then do we eliminate those spaces? You know, like, every space that has ever had trauma.
Well, good luck with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yin, I want to talk to you forever, but I don't want to keep you all day.
We've gone there. I'm so proud of this book. Thank you for co-creating this with Natalie West. And I don't know if I've ever actually met, I don't think I've ever actually met Natalie West in person. I hope to someday when I'm out in LA hanging with you.
Yes, come over. Come over. We'll all go for a hike. Yeah, no, Natalie's brilliant. And she worked really fucking hard for a really long time to make this book what it is today, and I'm glad I could help along the way, and I am so glad for you and all of the people who are involved, and I'm very excited for all of the listeners to be able to get their hands on a copy. They can order it online at feministpress.org, or as you've doubtlessly heard me say many times on the podcast already, both about this book and about Safe Sex, My Comic, and really just any indie book, contacting your local bookstore and saying that you're interested in this book, ordering it by the time you hear this, it's going to be out, so you'll be able to order it. You know, that not only gets you a copy of the book, and by the way, this is true for wherever you are in the world. You know, people are always adding me on social media and saying, I'm in Canada, I'm in this country, like, when am I going to be able to get it? And it's like, okay, well, it's not actually my job, but the answer to that question is always contact the person whose job it is, which is your local bookseller, and letting them know that you're interested also lets them know that there is an interest and that there might be a broader interest. If you want to know more about the book, obviously there's the hashtag #WeToo. If you're not already following me on Twitter and Instagram at TinaHornsAss, that's where I will be posting about all of the online events, which you can obviously attend from anywhere in the world. There's about 40 contributors of this book, and we are just trying to get everybody involved in one reading or one panel or another. I know that Yin is going to do a couple, and instead of naming them here, I'll just say, watch my feeds and watch Yin's feeds on social media, which are...
Instagram is at YinQ13, and then you can usually see some of the events then would be on YinQ.net. And also, I would ask that any sex workers who are listening, who are interested in posting to a private art gallery, please contact info@bodyofworkers.com or kinkoutevents@gmail.com.
Yes, and where can people find out more about everything that is going on with Kinkout?
Well, we are going to keep things rather on the quiet at this time while we're doing beta testing. Because when we truly launched, we want to make sure that all of the bells and whistles, but also all the privacy settings, all of the legal issues are sealed, so that we can protect the workers who will be posting their work, their art, their stories, as well as the virtual space.
Amazing. And if people want to find out about the archives of all of the work that Kinkout has done so far,
kinkoutevents.com, and then also
Instagram is at kinkoutevents.
Yeah. Okay.
Yin, it is so, so wonderful to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the show again, and I can't wait to embrace you and sweat it out on the dance floor.
You too. I love you.
I love you too. Enjoy the snow.
Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.